So,
just to conclude on this, just one of the things I want to say, one of the reasons why I wanted to give enough air to each of these is to say I thought each of them actually did address part of our interest in the aesthetic. And one might think then of the following question, to which I have no answer, not least at the moment. Namely, are there any ways in which these views could be held together? Could they be part of a more capacious view? That's one view. The opposite strategy, if I'm right that there's something suggestive about all of these, is... Actually, there are two possibilities. One further possibility is, are we so sure there's a univocal interest in the beautiful? Is the aesthetics necessarily one field, or might it be a diversity of fields with addressing diversity of interests? And maybe these ways of thinking, the precognitive, the multicognitive, the metacognitive, address different interests that are nonetheless all aesthetic in some way or another. And then the third range of issues is, as I suggested, some of these, the precognitive seems to only get its force from the beauty of nature, while the multicognitive and the multicognitive certainly gets its force from the question of the aesthetic, from the notion of art, fits art beauty best, which then asks, how does art beauty and the precognitive fit together, which we're going to have in about 2 weeks' time, and then how does the question of organic form relate to those? So one of the things although I've been pressing, first of all, I want to thank you for listening to me for now, I don't know, 9 or 10 weeks, on the tiny, tiny area of philosophy, you know, taking us from A to almost B. I've never had the opportunity to work at depth on a narrow problem for so long that people sat patiently and listened. And I've gotten further in my own thinking by talking to you and by being forced by you. So I really am grateful for your attention. I really have been moved by your questions and thoughts and all that. It's been actually exciting for me the last... but part of this is that, you know, I want, despite the fact that I'm pressing one view and think it's important, I want to leave all these other doors open for you. I do not want to suggest, despite the fact that I've been trying to defend one view, that you should give up on these other possible ways of thinking, that they seem to me significant and important. And I do not want to be thought to be pressing a dogmatic line here. As I always say to students, you should know that if I read an essay of yours and it merely agrees with everything I've been saying, you'll be asked to leave the program. I know what I think already. You don't have to tell me what I think in your essays. I want you to feel free in your essays to explore your interests, your drives, what's got your attention and why. Right? So I know I've been pushing one thing for a long time here, but I do not want that to drown out other things. Okay, anything else here before we at least introduce the sublime? Any questions? I truly exhausted this topic now. Please, we get to art.
Okay.
Because it all comes back in a different way. So the question when you think about art beauty should be, could we have a significant interest in art beauty if we didn't have an interest in natural beauty? That should be the question in the background of your thinking. Okay. You're thinking about Kant. Right? That's the thesis that Hegel absolutely denies, and that's the thesis that Kant in some way must be thought to be affirming. So if we're interested in what's the difference between a Kantian German idealist view and a Hegelian hermeneutical view, it comes to that, the role of natural beauty. Whether dispensable or indispensable. So the sublime. In the 18th century, the sublime became a topic again, above all through Burke. And if you're going to be thinking about the sublime, you need to read Burke on the sublime as background to Kant. Although Burke is much more psychological, he's also riveting and fascinating. Why in the 18th century did the sublime become a topic? And I want you to, I'm not going to answer that now. I want you to feel at least disturbed by the fact that suddenly the people were interested in the sublime. And the reason I mean I want you to be disturbed is I mean it is not obvious how terror and delight go together. Why should anyone be interested in experiencing terror or angst or privation or having a sense of fearfulness at the world, having a sense of being overwhelmed by the world, having a sense of the sublime? The sublime is certainly, as it appears in Kant and Burke, a area of danger of some kind. And the fact that we are drawn to this, are we drawn to it? Do we desire it? Do we desire our terror? Or do we desire fear? What are we desiring when we go in search of the sublime? And we do, in ways that we don't seek out beauty in quite the same way, we do kind of cultivate the divine, desire it. You know, we go to Niagara Falls in order to be overwhelmed or whatever. Why? Why? Kant, I think, sees the problem. But rather than facing it, I believe he tries to contain it. May even say sublate it. Which is why having Burke in the background would be helpful to you. See the way he's containing it. And throughout my account of Kant, I am going to at least play off of, let's call it, the desire for the sublime and the strategies of containment, of limiting or delimiting it, of controlling it, of diminishing it. I take containment to be the issue, since if the big topic of the Critique of Judgment is the purposiveness of nature, that's really the topic that's pushing the text forward, then the sublime clearly stands outside the framework of the investigation because it is contra-purposive. So, in some sense, I think Kant felt, because of Burke, that, so to speak, a book that turned out to be about the aesthetic could not fail. Indeed, even his own earliest writings, he took on the problem of the sublime. I think he thought that a text on the topic had to confront the sublime, but I almost sense that he does so unwillingly here, and that he has to crank it in various directions in order to make it fit into his framework in some way. And the way he's going to fit it into his framework is, of course, by moralizing it. So the notion of morality enters here in a way that, at least apart from the Longuenesse strategy, hasn't explicitly entered into the text. previously. So it's curious in a variety of ways. Secondly, and again, just these are just prefatory comments, since Kant, the sublime has continued to be a huge topic. That's the thought police. Shutting down the sublime, probably a Kantian. They'll ask us to leave the building. No sublime tonight. I take it the sublime has become one of the driving topics of modern continental philosophy. It is not an accident that Lyotard's book on aesthetics is on lessons of the sublime. If you read his writings on art, it's all about the sublime. The argument of my book, The Fate of Art, is that deconstruction is nothing but a strategy of the sublime. I'll come back to that in a second, but why one might think about that. But indeed, the sublime has, in a certain way, for us, displaced the beautiful as, especially, you might say, the difference between continental and analytic philosophy is analytic philosophers like the beautiful and continental philosophers like the sublime. You know, we like all the angst and suffering and contrapersonalness and all that. They just want to know everything's okay. So there are a varieties of the sublime. And I'll just mention a few of them. In his essay, The Beautiful and the Sublime, Guire sets out a few of these, and I'll follow his ordering for simplicity. So the deconstructive sublime suggests something like the following: that the sublime reveals an underlying and irremediable impossibility of determinate thought by showing that every attempt to produce a closure of conceptuality is impossible because it leaves out an excess that is incommensurable with that closure. So that the sublime moment is that moment of difference, which is the moment of deforming or difference beyond every categorization of identity and difference. So difference is a version of the linguistic sublime. You might say that another version of the linguistic sublime would say that the sayability of experience always rests on an unsayability of it. That the sayability is parasitic on what it cannot say, cannot claim, and can never capture. So the sublime in the linguistic register is not simply the moment of non-form, but of the unformed that lies behind and is conditioned for everything form. Meaning rests on non-meaning. In his wonderful book, The Art of Judgment, Howard Cagle tries to argue for a version of the perceptual sublime. And I quote from Kegel, pages 3, 45, 6. Just by the way, the passage is in the Guire. Kegel says the proportion of normal experience originates in the abnormal experience of the sublime. The regularity of proportion has its ground in the irregular violence of the sublime, and the life-enhancing form of beauty is traced back to the violent outrage which the imagination visited upon itself. The disposition of activity and passivity and resistance is the same phenomena as the violence of the mathematical sublime. When encountering objects in time, we are subject to their might, but we bring them under our dominion when we arrest them in space and determine them according to our proportions. So, Kegel's thought is that originary human experience is an experience of terrifying chaos, of being overwhelmed by the world, of having the world that is not at our disposal at all, and that in order to inhabit the world, we have to not just find order, but impose order. And that the relationship between... So that the sublime is a reminder of the antecedents to our orderly experience of the world, namely violent, inhospitable, and disenchanted nature, so that we, in the experience of the sublime, feel that we are having exactly the opposite experience to the experience of the exposure in the precognitive view. Namely, the precognitive view says, I expose myself, and lo and behold, there is form. And the sublime says, I expose myself, and I am undone. That nature is not commensurable with my needs, although I may have the power to dominate it. They try, but we don't need them. Do you want to open those doors again before we cook? Finally, one last version. Terry Eagleton says that the sublime gives an ideological interpretation of the sublime. And he says well, Eagleton's a Marxist, so we know why they're silencing him. He says, the beautiful and the sublime are, in fact, essential dimensions of ideology. For one problem of all humanist ideology is how its centering and consoling of the subject is to be made compatible with a certain essential reverence and submissiveness on the subject's part. The sublime is one of its aspects is exactly this chastening, humiliating power which decenters the subject into an awesome awareness of its finitude, its own petty position in the universe, just as the experience of beauty shores it up. So that the sublime is there for the sake in a bourgeois society of reminding us bourgeois, if we get too uppity, that we are really nothing. And that this is a way of the masters keeping their control over us. Certainly, I think that the notion of the sublime has more to it than Kant allows. In Kant, since you've already read it, I'm not letting the secret out of the bag, the only thing that's really sublime is reason itself. And that the experience of unformed nature, whether it's mathematical or dynamic forms, are occasions under which reason, which for Kant is our infinity, not our finitude, our power beyond any physical power, is what is revealed under these occasions. And because he thinks of the sublime as a way of affirming our reason and rationality, of affirming our transcendental vocation as free and self-determining subjects, that's what I mean by saying that Kant wants to contain the sublime. He wants to make the notion of the sublime harmonize. Despite the terror, despite the feelingness, the pleasure is always going to come with reason itself, which you may say seems prima facie implausible. What I want to suggest to you is don't be so quick to say that it's utterly implausible, because what Kant is interested in is the pleasure in the sublime. And the sublime cannot be sheer terror. In sheer terror, we pass away. In real fear, we don't stand around and gawk at the object. We run. So aesthetic pleasure, aesthetic fear, aesthetic terror, aesthetic angst is different from real fear, angst, terror. And right, the question here is the source of our pleasure in it. I will say, toward the end of my remarks, maybe I won't, so if I don't, remind me to say that we do have one obvious pre-modern occasion that is like the sublime, that is where we experience terror and fear and then pleasure, and we call that tragedy. And it is certainly needful for us to think that the notion of the sublime arose in a culture in which the notion of the tragic had lost its grip. And there's certainly we need to think about, therefore, the sublime as having a family resemblance to the notion of tragedy. Now, of course, that doesn't answer the question about the pleasure. That just raises the question, what's the pleasure in tragedy? There we go. Aristotle says catharsis. That doesn't help. Why? What? Okay. So that's the puzzle. Okay, the puzzle of the sublime is this puzzle of these twinning of the contrapurposive, the fearful, and then the pleasurable. paragraph 23, any questions before I launch into paragraph 23? That was just set up. Paragraph 23 opens with a set of analogies between the sublime and the beautiful. And I'm just going to list them. Kant lists five. First, he says, both the sublime and the beautiful are liked for their own sake. That is, disinterestedly. And again, we now know that that disinterest is a complicated phenomena, but it certainly has something to do with the pleasure is disinterested. And I will want to ask you, is Kant right in suggesting that the pleasure of the sublime isn't really disinterested? I have my doubts about that. Secondly, he says, appropriately enough, they are both judgments of reflection. Third, in these judgments of reflection, the object is referred indeterminately to concepts. That is, we do not subsume the objects, whether sublime or beautiful, under any determinate concepts. And it has to be referred to our powers of conceptualization without nonetheless conceptualizing. That's true in both cases. Fourth, it is connected to the mere power of exhibition of the imagination in relationship to another faculty. In the case of the beautiful, it's the exhibition in the imagination in relationship to the understanding. In the case of the sublime, it's the exhibition in the imagination in relationship to reason. So reason plays something like the role, in the case of the sublime, that the understanding played in the beautiful. And finally, for both, although they are singular intuitions, this is sublime, this is beautiful, we yet expect universal validity from our judgments. So although they're not being brought under a concept, we nonetheless think that they have universal validity. So something about our state in response to them has that status. What about the disanalogy? Beauty is a response to the form of objects. The sublime is a response to formlessness or unboundedness. But it's not just formlessness or unboundedness itself. It's formlessness and unboundedness in relationship to the thought of totality. So it's not just, and I'll explain this in detail when I do the mathematical sublime, but you have to, when you're thinking about the sublime, we are always, how we say, trying to think about the sublime as one. So we have a kind of totalizing ambition with respect to it. And it's that totalizing ambition that's going to fail. Without the totalizing ambition, our wanting to hold it in the imagination, it couldn't be contrapurposiveness, right? So there has to, that notion of totality is functioning here in the way in which the demand of the understanding for unity functions in the judgment of the beautiful. So the role of totality or unconditionedness plays a role, the role that unity played in the beautiful. In both cases, however, the reference is to an indeterminate concept. So in the case of the beautiful, it's an indeterminate concept of the understanding, something concept-like, we actually say. In the case of the sublime, it's an indeterminate concept of reason. And it's important that it be indeterminate. That is, it refers us to the faculty of reason, which is, I'll say more about, but it's the faculty of the thought of the unconditioned. But it must be referred to it indeterminately, because if it were determinate, it would just be a moral judgment. Right? If my response to it is, it's the moral law, then I'd have to, as it were, act on it. And this is free from action. So it doesn't generate in me, so it can't, it's clear, I think it's puzzled. When I experience the moral law normally, I experience it as a motive to act in one way rather than another. I experience it as telling me that this desire should not be acted on, but another desire should be. So the experience of the moral law is, under normal conditions, practical. That is action-related. If there is anything like a moral experience in the experience of the sublime, and Kant thinks there is, it has to be indeterminately, because it's not telling us to do anything in particular. It's simply a, what is an indeterminate awareness of our reason? It's an coming to a sudden awareness of my vocation in general as a rational and free being. That in the face of the sublime, Kant is going to say, I experience myself as inhabiting both a sensible and a supersensible domain. That is, or an empirical and a noumenal domain. So it's about my transcendence of sensibility, and that is constitutive of who I am überhaupt. That's that. So that's what I mean by it's an indeterminate experience of it. In the case of the beautiful, there is a qualitative liking. In the case of the sublime, there is a quantitative disliking. That the sublime, in the first instance, has a quantitative dimension. And indeed, there's a book coming out, of which, by the way, there's an article, there's a preview in the Kukla, by Melissa Zinkin, who has got this book coming out on Kant's aesthetic that is totally based on the idea of intensive magnitudes. And it's terrific stuff. I mean, I think Melissa's a terrific young philosopher. So she's really taking this intensity stuff and the response to it and taking it from the first critique, that idea, which almost plays a terrible role in the first critique, and drives into Kant's aesthetics in a really fascinating way. So so that's the disliking. It's the quantitative feature, that the idea of intensive magnitudes is to say that when we're dealing with the sublime, both the mathematical and the dynamic, there is a quantitative aspect to it. and not a mere qualitative one, a formal one. The liking of the beautiful is a furtherance of life, imagination, and understanding in free play, that dynamic. The liking of the sublime, Kant says on page 245, involves a momentary inhibition of vital forces, followed immediately by an outpouring of them that is all the stronger. So it is, I keep thinking of it as a near-death experience. That it's that experience of being taken over by a wave, and you start tumbling, and you know, at least for a fraction of a second, you're going to die. That you are hopeless and powerless in this, have you gone through this? And then you're on the beach, and you feel utterly exhilarated. It's as if only in that proximity with death do we get reminded that we are alive. There are other ways of unpacking that metaphor, but I'll skip them. Kant thinks of the beautiful as free play. He says about the sublime that it involves a tremendous seriousness. There's something serious about the sublime. I'm going to stop with that, because Lyotard has a lot to say about the seriousness of the sublime. If I started now unpacking that, the police would be out and we'd get in trouble again. Have a nice Thanksgiving.